He is going to talk a little bit with us about some of the process that the department goes through when they do internal audits. And then I think he is going to, at least I hope he's going to, because I think I remember asking him to also talk to us about some of the latest internal audits that they have done and what the results of those audits have been and what kind of actions are being taken by the department. So, George and Lori, and I mean all three of you can come up if you'd like. And I apologize to the overflow crowd, and we have seating available in hearing room.
Mr. Chair, other folks recognize that when we get asked to testify on these interesting things, that if they listen very long, their brains will turn to mush.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what that says about the members of this committee.
Maybe our brains are all turning to mush.
Very solid oatmeal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the Acting Director for Department Administrative Services. I'm going to talk ever so briefly here, and then George is going to do the bulk of this. But I wanted the committee to know before George started talking about our internal audits and what has gone on over the results of those and things, is that this is a very high-valued function for the director's office in DAS. It reports to the director, and it is one of the keys I see to our organizational success as we move forward, because it's the only function in the department that takes time out to look thoughtfully at what's going on, assesses the risks the department has in various areas, and provides objective, independent, professional advice to all of the management levels in the department. They review the processes that we have going on with an eye towards best practices and improving the outcomes for the department. They continually update our knowledge of key issues through the audit findings and recommendations. They look at controls to make sure that what we have in place are adequate to mitigate our risk. And they make thoughtful, practical recommendations. Now, not all managers would say that, but I think they're recommendations generally that the department can implement within the resources we have available to us. And they provide a strong ethical and values piece within the organization, because they are that objective third party, yet it is internal, so there's trust levels and such that have developed there over time. So it's a key function for us. The risk assessment that George is going to talk about is very important to me as the director, to know which areas are the highest risk in the department, which have sort of moderate and which are lower, and that we work with our managers so that they too understand those kind of gradations in risk, and that we look to find management ways to appropriately address all of those. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll let George go ahead and talk about the specifics of the internal audits, but it is a very high priority for the department. There are three internal auditors, so it's a very small resource that we have, and we try to leverage that in the most important areas. So.
Well, thank you, Lori. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is George Dunford. It's a pleasure to be back before you again. I wish I could bring a larger audience with me for you, but I have not been successful in doing that, and I apologize. I am the internal auditor.
On TV, George, it's okay.
Okay. Hopefully they're seeing me on TV. I am the internal audit manager for the Department of Administrative Services. I did bring the one thing I do remember Chair Cromwell asking me to make sure I had was cash on me today. And so I did bring some cash, not for you necessarily, Mr. Chair, but for the piggy bank. So I make sure I pay my dues up front. That's how I do it on the job every day. We are, as Lori pointed out, and I thank my boss for that nice introduction, because the one thing I can tell you truthfully is I know that we are valued there in the department. It is not always the easiest job in the world to talk to people about what they're doing, in our opinion, incorrectly. But I have to say that I've been impressed with the management at the Department of Administrative Services, because they actually acknowledge when they may be doing something that could be improved. So that's the first step, I think, to change. And I'm happy to report that we are engaged in that every day. Now, we are a very small unit of a very small director's office, I might add, for a very big department. Generally, there are three of us, However, it seems to me that it's hard to keep three on the job because, number one, there's a pretty good demand for folks with these talents. And number two, we tend to hire people that are not just very well qualified, but very good at their jobs, and they get promoted rather quickly. So I don't know what that says about me, but I do know that I'm still in the job. Now, with me on the job, and she's been with me since I started at DAS in this position, is Margaret Kane, whom I'd like to introduce to you today. She's sitting in the front row. Margaret is a seasoned veteran of the Secretary of State's Audit Division. For many years, she's done a number of financial and performance audits throughout her career, and she is a certified public accountant and a certified fraud examiner. And she and I do most all, if not all, of the work with respect to risk assessments and audit reports. And so I'll go over all of those with you briefly today. And I did talk to the chair earlier about our risk assessment process, so I'd like to talk to you about that this morning as well. Now, Mr. Chair, I would also ask you to let me know, in terms of time constraint, I usually like to take up the entire couple hours, but if you don't mind, I'll be brief on this, and then I'll open it to questions if that's okay with you folks.
I think that would be fine.
Okay. To start into the substantive presentation, let me just mention to you that the audit function at the department is not unlike those that exist in other departments, in my opinion. We have an internal audit committee. I report to the director, but I also report to the internal audit committee. The internal audit committee, while they are employees, with one exception of the state of Oregon, they tend to think fairly independently. And I know that because of the amount of time it takes to run through reports and findings with them. So they take this very seriously. On our audit committee is the Human Resource Services Division Administrator, Sue Wilson, the Operations Division Administrator, Bill Fink, the State Controller, John Radford, and Lori Warner, of course, is the Director. And then we have an external position, which I have to report to you that I have tried for about a year to recruit an individual locally that does not work for state government who is a certified public accountant, but the time commitment has been my undoing. It does take quite a bit of time on this committee in terms of the review process. So I am still doing in the recruitment phase of that and intend to continue. In the meantime, however, we were lucky enough to have Cameron Burney, who is the former administrator of the purchasing division for the state, who is now retired and a real estate broker in the Portland metro area. He's graciously agreed for the rest of this calendar year to serve on the committee. He has broad knowledge, obviously, in purchasing and contracting, and that is actually quite helpful to us when we present our findings with respect to those issues. Now, generally, the committee meets about once every quarter. However, they do meet whenever we need to talk about issues. So they've been very responsive. And I have to apologize publicly that it does take an inordinate amount of time, but the reason it will take probably a lot of time in 2005 is because we're going through our risk assessment process. In my opinion, once we get the basis for that in place, the time commitment should lessen, and I should be more successful in my external recruiting efforts. And I'll be happy to talk to you about that again when I'm successful. Let's talk about the risk assessment process for a moment. We start out... Well, first let me mention to you that there have been risk assessments done in the past. There's a high-level risk assessment done by the Secretary of State's office, generally, and we used their risk assessment in 2004 as the basis for our audit plan. In 2005, we chose to actually do our own risk assessment, which was much more detailed and much more involving to the extent that it involved several layers of not just senior management but lower-level section management as well. We start the process with a couple of in-depth surveys, documents that we actually require written responses to. And a different survey goes to an administrator, for instance, as opposed to a section manager. And we take those responses, and they were provided to us in a timely way, and I certainly have no complaints about that because they were rather involved. But they ask questions about what the mission of that section is, for instance, if we're talking about a section manager. What is it that you are to accomplish? What sorts of barriers are there to the accomplishment of that mission? What are the risks that you control? What are the risks that you don't control? And it's nice to get these opinions because they literally are all over the map. But we take that and in a very scientific way, because I have to tell you, as a trial lawyer, one of the mechanisms I used to use was a matrix in terms of trying to figure out and anticipate the other side's questions. And it is very much akin to how we did the risk assessment this time, to the extent that we try to anticipate all the risks. And we actually try to anticipate risk with an eye towards controls that are in place and controls that aren't there. And that way we can actually rank the risks according to the gravity of the impact. Because the first thing you look at is the risk. The second thing you look at is the impact of something bad happening. Take cybersecurity, for instance. It is a risk that is very difficult to control. And I doubt seriously if the risk ever is ever really evaporates. As long as you have humans on this planet, I don't think there'll ever be a computer system that's totally secure. But there are things you can do to mitigate that risk, controls you can have in place to mitigate that risk. The next level of inquiry then goes to impact. What happens if the system is breached? What happens if the risk comes to pass and the system is breached and there is some loss? Then that's when we look at the impact, and we actually rank that as well. So what I want to show you, I didn't bring this as a handout because, frankly, this has risks in place that it would not be good for the state to have in the public eye at this point, because we haven't mitigated them fully. But I want to show you basically a snapshot of what our risk assessment looks like is this. It's actually a matrix where we, on the column side, array the programs, okay, or the program issues. And on the row side, we actually array the risk. And you'll see colors there. Red, obviously, would mean high risk. Green would mean a minimal risk, or at least a minimal impact. Yellow would mean that there are mitigating controls that are either aren't in place or aren't fully finished. And then gray would mean those are risks that we identify but are totally outside our control, and there's nothing we can do to actually prevent them from happening.
Now, George, do you blow those up so that you can actually see the font? Because when I looked at those in my office, the font was so tiny I didn't have my magnifying glass.
Yes. Mr. Chair, we do blow these up, and the only reason I have it in this font that I actually learned from Representative Butler during a Ways and Means presentation, I have it in that font size because I can put it on one page. But certainly our risk assessment goes for several pages if you actually could read it. And by the way, with a magnifying glass, and I'm not kidding, you really can read the risk, and you can read how we rated the risk and the impact, because there are two ratings that go with each one of those colors. And we rate those basically high, medium, and low on both the risk and the impact. So we actually have applied, and it's not it's not a practice, by the way, excuse me, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that is unique to the Department of Administrative Services. It actually is utilized by several states and other departments within state and federal and local governments. So it's not something I dreamed up, and I wish I could take credit for it. I think it's very good.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. George, and I don't think this is a hypothetical question, but I, in as much as you've talked about examining the risks that are associated with our mainframe and database in the state, much of the data that's on our computer systems, we've worried about it being accessible to the third parties through breaking through our firewall and having it accessed improperly. When you talk about what's the worst that can happen relative to a database, is the complete loss of your database not as great of a loss as a corruption and the inability to determine inaccurate information that might have been planted in there that could be, in effect, a time bomb in your system? Which is the greater risk? Which is the greater loss to the system?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I don't know. I know that the one thing I am very truthful about is the limits of my expertise. And I can tell you that I would rank those risks as equal to the extent that they both would have a devastating impact on the state's business. You could ask another question as well, and that would be, is it a higher risk to have your data corrupted than it would be to have that data lost to the extent that it would be in the hands of a third party? That also would be a tremendous risk, and the impact would be astronomically bad. So we don't get down to the level of which is the worst risk. We identify both of them as high risk, high impact.
Mr. Chair, and the reason I'm anxious about, and again, corrupted data, it would seem to me that in many respects, corrupted data would be worse than the total loss of the data. At least with regard to the total loss of the data, you've taken steps to have grandfather and great-grandfather backups of the data and the input over a period of time, the authorized input. But I'm anxious where that may lead us in the process of what we do, both with regard to the backup of the databases as well as the security that we have in place, George. And I'd like to get into some of that specifics, but Mr. Chair, I'm anxious about getting into specifics of our database in the state with the Department of Administrative Services on public record. I think that maybe that would be more appropriate in a private arrangement with yourself and the Department of Administrative Service. There are some questions, I understand that we may have actually may have fairly regular breaches of our databases, and I would like to have and I know that there are high level discussions that go on about those kinds of things, but I'd like to have some assurance by the time we leave this session from Mr. Dunford that at least with regard to the unauthorized accesses or the oversight that is exercised over the potential corruption and or unauthorized access of our databases, that we have those systems in place that can help us identify. And I know that you do that. I not just intuitively, because I've talked to some of your manager. As a matter of fact, even when we've talked to other of our information management resource folks, that they had in fact been able to identify the very desk and the computers that were accessing and inappropriately entering data or inappropriately accessing data that had opportunities to corrupt some of our information. So I know that we've taken a lot of procedure precautions to implement the internal controls to help us in that regard. But Mr. Chair, I'm just assuming that you will have or have had and will continue to have ongoing discussions with Mr. Dunford and others and the Department of Administrative Service to satisfy yourself to give us assurances within the legislative process that there will be no serious intrusion, but what we will know about it, and that you'll know about the intrusion soon, very soon after or when it happens. I guess it's not a question of if it happens; it's when it happens, and then that we are continuously taking the steps to update our ability to try and keep those unauthorized access, those unauthorized corruptible influences out of our system.
I think, let me jump in here for a second, George. I think there's actually three questions there. One is with not only with regards to loss of data, and then with regards to corruption of data, but the third thing is, the third real big question is not necessarily a loss of the data, other than third party having been able to access it and then use the data for nefarious purposes. I can tell you that as a with regards to the IT security, because of my membership on the Joint Legislative Interim Committee on Information Management and Technology, as well, and actions that we took, as well as because of my membership during session on the House IMT Committee, as well as this committee, there have been several discussions that I've had, not only with George, but also with Don Fleming and Teresa Massey, who is the state chief security officer for the state, relative to the to IT security and how that is being approached. I think that it is part of the public record that in December the JLCIMT, which is a Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology, approved and sent to the e-board a request from the Department of Administrative Services Information Resource Management Division, which is IRMD, a request for, I believe it was about $9 million. Was it $9 million or $15 million?
A little lower, but that's...
A little lower, $7 million. Anyway, it was a bunch of money for the purposes of getting started on not only the perimeter of the state system as we are moving forward with a state data center to have everything consolidated into one place. Not only the perimeter, but also then starting to look at the security for the individual applications. That's about as far as I can really go with it, because if we start talking about any more specifics than that, that really starts allowing the bad guys the opportunity to start going in and looking at those systems. I can tell you that in 2002, the Department of Human Services came under quite a bit of fire because there were some breaches that had been noticed there that were potentially quite dangerous. So I can assure you that there are steps being taken to try to address this. I think one of the things, and would always be interesting for all of us to do, would be to have a session with Don Fleming and Teresa Massey. But one of the things that is really critical with regards to the IT area is that the attackers are becoming much more sophisticated than they were even 2 years ago. And, you know, 2, 4, 6 years ago, it was sort of what were referred to as the script kiddies. You know, the 13-year-olds getting out of school at 3:30, going home, nobody's home, they get on the computer, they start banging away, and all of a sudden they're, you know, they find themselves into some computer system, and they're just kind of playing around, and they don't really necessarily mean to do any harm, but they end up doing some harm, or getting information that they shouldn't have, or writing code that is then inserted into the system. And the script kiddies were, but what has happened is that even the 13-year-olds, with the tools that are available on the web, have become a lot more sophisticated than they were. So consequently, these attacks are definitely increasing. The other thing is with regards to the number of attacks. You know, a couple of years ago, you know, if you had an attack a month or attack every 6 months, that sort of thing, it wasn't necessarily uncommon. Now it's not uncommon to be, you know, every hour. And you even see in the, you know, companies like Norton, which is operated by Symantec or McAfee, that their job is the security. IT security arena, and they're constantly hour by hour practically writing code to offset some kind of an attack that has now been propagated out on the internet. So with this giant network that we have anymore, it's pretty incredible that, you know, all of this activity can come about. The one thing probably that would keep it, the only thing that I could see that would keep a computer system probably 98% secure would be to disconnect it from the network. completely. So it doesn't have, so you don't have your wireless connection, you don't have your wired connection, and the reason why I said only 98% is because there's still a 2% chance that if somebody were looking over your shoulder and they got your password, that they could get into your system and do things that you wouldn't want them to do or get information that you wouldn't want them to get.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the commentary, and I have to assure members of the committee, Representative Butler, that the department takes that very, very seriously. And as you know, Mr. Chair, at some of the latest testimony before the House Information Technology Committee, that all came to pass in terms of the sorts of risks we have and the kinds of responses we engage in to mitigate those risks. We're engaged in that right now, actually, so that's ongoing. Unfortunately, because as you correctly pointed out, the sophistication seems to increase with each passing day. So our sophistication must also increase to meet that challenge. So we take it seriously, and I assure you that not talking about it doesn't mean we don't want to talk about it.
I'm just convinced, Mr. Chair, that if these folks that are doing these attacks and unauthorized entries would spend equal amount of time and brain power and trying to overcome and find cancer cures, that we would have probably cured cancer by now. So
yeah.
I just don't understand it. It's such a huge drain on the resources of government and industry and business and private resources, and it's such a huge amount of time that's expended by people who are obviously very, very intelligent, very intuitive thinking people that can think through these issues and have very good brain capacity to remember things, because they can go through and do these things and hack this stuff fairly easily. I just have to believe that if that same amount of time and energy and the money that we spend in government and industry, if we could have diverted that all over to a cure for cancer, we'd probably have the world cancer-free by now.
We could certainly hope to, anyway. George, I'd like to shift gears for just a second and move off of IT for a moment and ask you another question relative to the risk assessments, and that is the risks that have been identified with the state owning property and having the various facilities that we have, and the risks that there are with that versus the risks when we rent from outside organizations or the private sector. Or has there been any sort of look at that to see what kind of, in other words, is it a lower risk for the state to go lease property from the private sector, or is it a lower risk to the state to actually own the facilities and manage them ourselves?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question. Although that has come up in discussion with respect to the risk assessment survey instrument, that is not something that is arrayed on our risk assessment in terms of private versus public.
Okay.
It would be, let me say this to that, though, to the extent that it would be more expensive one way or the other, obviously there are risk factors associated with that,
mm-hmm.
and we would be interested in that and are interested in that. But in terms of risks, the inherent difference between private and public ownership, I'm not so sure I could identify the risks there as far as arraying on a matrix. I'm not suggesting there aren't. I'm just suggesting to you I don't know of what value that would be to you.
I understand. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Sure.
Okay, go ahead and proceed.
Okay. I want to briefly touch on some of the more recent audits and then talk to you a little bit about some of the statewide review work we've done. To give you a couple of examples of recent internal audits, we completed in early 2004 a rather lengthy review of expenditures at our Human Resource Management Division. And that was a good test. For instance, I think there's an inherent supposition that someone that works for the state and serves on a committee couldn't possibly be independent. And I have to tell you that I was impressed with Sue Wilson's ability to serve on the audit committee while her division was being scrutinized by me. Certainly, I have to say, I'm not so sure I would have performed quite as stellar as I actually think she did. Very fair, very focused, and changed a lot of processes and procedures as a result of our audit. But for the most part, no material findings. But we did find, in terms of trying to achieve the excellence that the department sets for itself as an example for the rest of state government, you always, it seems like, find the exceptions where you may find an expenditure that didn't have the proper authorization, and you have to chase down exactly what the item was, and was it actually something the state used. We didn't find any situation where we had unauthorized, totally, completely unauthorized expenditures. We did find examples, however, where they weren't documented properly. We found examples also where the procedures and the policy wasn't strong enough. Those have changed. And so in our follow-up this year, we expect that we'll find many, many, many fewer examples of that, and at least that's our supposition, and we'll find out. We'll test it. The other thing that's that we find routinely is in the segregation of duties area. Someone that's receiving, not cash, but receiving items, goods, buying items, and also paying for them. That's, you know, for obvious reasons, not a good idea. It's certainly not a good practice. We point those out, we get those changed. Generally, though, I will tell you that the policies in place prohibit those sorts of actions, and we find that routinely as well. It's most of the time, it's either the press of business, the urgency of the issue, or just forgetfulness. But we've not found anything material that would cause us great pause in what we found. We write these up fairly professionally, I think, in our report. They're examined thoroughly by the audit committee, and then we go back and follow up to see whether the processes and the procedures and the policies actually are put in place. So that's an example from the Human Resource Management Division.
George, let me just ask a quick question about that with regards to the Human Resource Division, because one of the things that has come to my attention and maybe other members' attention as well is the issue of the testing that goes on when people are being considered for hiring and that sort of thing. And this may be something that's completely off the log from a standpoint of being part of any audit that you've done with the Human Resource Management Division. But has there been a look at that to see if it would be... to see if it if the testing actually gets us what we're trying to get at with it, or is it sort of an exercise that while it's you know, sort of expected, because when you work for the government you have to, you know, do a lot of paperwork and everything. I guess what I'm getting at, is it found to really be worthwhile, or is that something that's not really even been looked at?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've not looked at that. No.
Okay.
So I can't actually speak with any intelligence to your question, but I will say that I know that there is an audit section with specific expertise in human resource management within the Human Resource Management Division. They do look at those things.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another audit, which was a lengthy, very lengthy review, actually, of the Enterprise Network Services section of the Information Resource Management, the Information Resource Management Division, what you commonly have heard referred to as IRMD. When we talk about risk, if you were to actually look at our risk matrix, you would see there are certainly sensitive issues on there with respect to statewide systems, and the majority of those are managed by the Information Resource Management Division. These are areas which we just spoke about in terms of managing risk, which is generally very hard to control. Hacking a system is hard for us to control because it happens generally on an external basis. We identify those risks. In this review of Enterprise Network Services, however, it wasn't about cybersecurity as much as it was about management of that large division within the Information Resource Management Division. And we found that management controls could have been improved in a variety of areas, certainly in contract management, in the administration of contracts, cost controls, duplication of work, relationships with consultants and contractors, and an ongoing, interestingly enough, ongoing working relationship with our own operations division, the very people that actually write the checks and pay the vendors that contract with Information Resource Management Division. This was another instance where it was a very, very difficult review to do, to the extent that you're looking at yourself so critically. And I have to tell you that one of the things I have learned in this job, unlike trial law, you go into battle knowing that one side doesn't like you. But in the audit world, you go into battle knowing neither side. Nobody likes you. and that took me a little while to get used to, but it's one of those things that's just part of the job. You try to put that behind you and do good work. This was a situation where that was an eye-opener for me, to the extent that we would actually be allowed access, the access that we were given. Very little pushback on that. Policies have changed. Personnel have changed as a result of this. So this is a situation where I think it does showcase the ability of DAS to not just scrutinize and look at itself, but really take action that sometimes is very difficult to take. We are happy to report in that case, if we were to go back, I'm sure we would see dramatic changes.
George, in IMD, I can assure you that you would see, based on what I've seen over the last 6 years, you would see dramatic changes.
I agree.
But just generally speaking, not necessarily speaking to IRMD or any individual division, do you find that when you go in to do an audit, that is it? Do the staffs and the management sort of look at it from a standpoint of being, here they come and they're going to find us out, or they're going to find out something that, you know, we don't want them to, like they've got something to hide? Or is it, or do they look at it more along the lines of, okay, here's another set of eyes that's looking at our processes, looking at what we're doing, and is going to make recommendations that may help us operate better?
Mr. Chair, thank you for that question, because frankly that was one of the items I wanted to cover with you today. The answer to that is going to be mixed. I will tell you this, though. The strength of internal audit as opposed to an external audit is generally you will find people more willing to talk to you because they know you are actually part of the management structure within the organization they work for. No one likes to talk, in my experience, nobody that I've dealt with likes to talk about areas that they know they are not doing well in. I have not found any instance when people weren't forthright, though, about what they actually accomplish and what they do. And certainly with the records available, we can identify those outside a discussion with that individual anyway. So the short answer to your question is it varies, but for the most part internally, I've not run into any brick walls with respect to getting information. And people welcome us generally after they've read the report and seen the changes that occur as a result of that report. That's been my experience. Now, I'm not going to suggest to you that's the experience of every internal auditor, because I don't know, but it's been mine.
Okay, thank you.
Moving on, I want to talk to you briefly also about a couple of internal audits, which were rather lengthy, that we engaged in with our Office of Business Administration, now known as the Operations Division. As you know, the Operations Division really is the accounting arm of our department for internal transaction purposes. We reviewed and evaluated the management controls related to processing disbursements and receiving cash and other revenues. We found that in not all cases was the supporting documentation easily available. Again, this is a situation, though, I have to say, and I'm happy to report, that we didn't find areas where we couldn't, if we tracked down the information, verify that it was a valid purchase. But it is better business practice to have that readily available in case there's an external audit. And so we've changed those practices as well. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'm not so sure that's always greeted with euphoria to have to get a management signature on an expenditure. But we see more of that now than we did before we went in. On the receiving of revenues, we take that very, very seriously, because, believe it or not, some people still send cash in envelopes. I mean, it's unusual now. It's certainly not as prevalent as it used to be, but we found instances where that does happen. And we're very strict about having more than one person open the mail. because in those situations where you have cash, it is always good to have someone looking over your shoulder, and then we keep a log of what cash comes in when it's receipted. We found a few instances where that wasn't always the case. That has changed. Another mundane item, but very important, I think, is restrictively endorsing checks immediately when they're received. We do that. Prior to the internal audit, we found instances where that wasn't always done in a timely way. It is always done. It's just not always done quickly. So we're sticklers on those issues, as mundane as they may sound. I think they're very important, and I think Lori and the senior management of the department would agree. Part of our audit process also involves complying with the Oregon Accounting Manual. The Oregon Accounting Manual requires, through its internal audit requirements, that we look at the small purchase order transaction system. What you've commonly heard is SPOTS. It's a quick purchase order transaction system or transaction method that allows less paperwork. So we go in and we look at that. And what we generally found was the transactions are very small. They're not necessarily numerous, they're just small. And in some cases, there isn't always a manager that signed off on the purchase. We've asked that change as well, and we'll go back in and relook at that very soon. But those are the kinds of issues that we've found with respect to the SPOTS program or the SPOTS methodology. By the way, I might add, too, that since that is a rather seasoned system now, and initially when John Radford proposed that, it was met with some trepidation by many of us in the analyst in the budget world, because it is seemingly a tough thing to control to give somebody a credit card. But there are enough controls in place there where I think it's actually a fairly seasoned and mature system now. And I would argue that it probably doesn't require an audit every 6 months. I might go to a yearly one on that one if I convince them to change the Oregon County Manual. Because what we found just wasn't material. And I'm not so sure it's a good use of time.
George, how would you put in with the SPOTS program, how would you put in the management signature requirement control? Because isn't that intended to be, as I understand it anyway, is intended to be a system that lower-level managers and employees, you know, basically you have a cash card or the credit card that they can go and use for, you know, you got a mechanic that needs another wrench over in the motor pool, or, you know, so it's a, and it's, you know, it's a wrench that costs, you know, $63.95, and I mean, so how would you have a manager signature requirement for something like that when it's probably more effective for the, you know, parts runner to run out and get the.
Right, and Mr. Chair, let me answer that because it's a good question. When I first looked at the SPOTS program, I've never been a huge believer in after-the-fact approvals, but in this case, it's actually very important. Because what you have is you do have an instant decision that's made on the spot about whether to get something, small purchase, rather than go through and do a purchase order, wait around for the purchase order to be cut and cleared, and then run over to Home Depot to pick up the wrench. It's much easier to go to Home Depot, buy the wrench, get back to the job, and get your work done. But it's also important for us to know that that wrench was used for state service business, okay, and actually exists in an inventory someplace. So we have a manager. We have three levels of review on this. The manager actually signs after the fact to make sure that was an authorized purchase, because that manager must look at the purchase statement, okay, that we get monthly. The state pays the bill directly. Manager reviews it after the fact. Prior to the payment going out, after the purchase is made, prior to the payment going out, the manager reviews. We also have a subsequent review in the operations division. We have a staff person that reviews all our SPOTS card purchases, and they actually see what the item is. And you'll be surprised that you can, through that process, figure out readily whether or not it's a legitimate purchase. We've not seen any that weren't. The one we did see was actually reversed almost instantly when it was made. So that was, we know the scrutinizing process works. But that's the manager approval I talked about.
Almost okay. Instantly, I'm interested in that, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Brett.
Almost instantly, George, would that like be like perhaps
laying down a credit card at the store and then realizing the purchase that was just made, you presented the wrong credit card.
Yes, and what happened in that case, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, was the manager made the purchase, realized, I believe this, pulled the wrong credit card out, had them refund on that credit card, and pulled the right credit card out and paid for the, or cash, paid for the item.
Personal item.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, generally, George, what's the signature authority on one of those cards?
Mr. Chair, generally the signature authority isn't over 1,500.
Okay.
In terms of a limit on the card. I will tell you that one of the things we looked at was a fraudulent series of transactions that occurred from overseas. Someone evidently had a random number generator and were able to pick off one of our SPOTS cards at the Department of Administrative Services and made a couple of purchases. And we immediately, because of the system that we have in place in the operations division, caught these purchases as obvious non-state purchases because they were made from outside the U.S. Notified U.S. Bank and had the transactions reversed, and now there's a hold on any transaction arising from outside the 48 contiguous states will not be processed. Now, I'm not aware that we buy anything overseas, but if we do, we have another mechanism for that, and you can't do it quite as quickly as you can on a SPOTS card.
So on that Alaskan cruise that you're thinking about for this summer,
if you happen to
pull out the wrong credit card, there's going to be a stop put on that right immediately because you're not within the 48 contiguous states.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Moving on, also, we looked at some of the management controls related to contracts. Our office, or the operations division, also manages contracts. They've taken a much more proactive role in managing contracts and procurements within the department. Obviously, a lot through what Lori is requiring of senior managers now, and also the fact that it just makes good business sense to have a contract file which has all the information in the file. So if there is an external review or an internal review of any kind, you can pull the contract file and see the history of that contract and procurement. That wasn't always the case previously, and certainly DAS isn't the only department that had that issue. I mean, the Secretary of State would tell you one of the big three issues generally in terms of audit findings are contract and procurement issues. So we're making a gallant attempt to change that within the department, and we're trying to change that internally. So we'll follow up on this at the end of this year, sometime in September or October of this year, to see exactly how we did. But we were pleased with the response from the Operations Division Administrator in terms of the changes to policy and procedure. They're taking a much more active role within the Operations Division of managing the Information Resource Management Division contracts as well, because that division does hire many consultants, as you can probably imagine, for its statewide systems. We have a series...
George. So that's for contracts for both personal services as well as for equipment, supplies, all of those types of contracts that are out there?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Would that include the procurement contract that we have with Silver Oak, which is primarily, I believe, an IT contract?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that would include Silver Oak, yes.
Has there been a... I want to pursue this for just a second, George. Has there been a real good look at that contract in terms of the... Because I believe it's been in place now for, about a year and a half? As far as the performance of Silver Oak and actually providing the savings that they came in and said that they were going to provide to the state, and how those savings have either been reallocated or put back into the general, has there been a real good look at that?
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair. Interestingly enough, about 4 weeks ago, 5 weeks ago, I met with representatives of Silver Oak, not so much to review the contract, but to follow up on John Marina, who is the sort of external assurance that was required under that contract. There's a contract provision that requires that somebody outside of Silver Oak validates the savings that are in the contract. And John Marina did so, and The thought process now is that we can, in internal audit, take that methodology and apply that to the contract in the future, or contracts like that in the future. But I felt comfortable in reviewing Mr. Bermina's work that there was a fairly thorough examination of the savings portion of the contract. Now, I did not look at the contract for purposes of legal sufficiency or any other item. So I can't talk to you in terms of the allocation, but I can talk to you in terms of the representations made in the contract were very seriously taken by us, because that contract revolves around savings.
Right, exactly. And that's one of the things that I'm concerned about. Now, I do know, I believe it was Virginia, also has a contract with Silver Oak. One of the things that they did in their this does not border, even come close to bordering on brilliance. But that for the first, Silver Oak was guaranteeing, I think, for a certain expenditure limitation, about $8 million in savings. Under the contract, the state of Virginia is paying them basically dollar for dollar on that first $8 million in savings. And then, but the contract, the result of the contract actually calls for, I think it's 50 cents on the dollar, that as far as a fee that's paid to Silver Oak for their work. But on that first $8 million, so basically it's, here's $8 million, now go save us 16, and then we're good, because it will add up to 50 cents on the dollar. And I'm just concerned about how it is that our contract is written for the state of Oregon with them. And then the other side to that, of course, what keeps them on the job performing once they've basically been paid? Is there a penalty as well as what I'm looking for?
A penalty versus a sort of reward?
Yeah, thank you. Hello. A penalty versus and reward system into the contract. So basically, if they don't perform, or they don't perform in the time frame that they said that they're going to, so on and so forth. That and I know that there's been, in some areas, there's also been on some of the procurements, there's been a little bit of a pushback from vendors as well as from some of the purchasers within the state. And I'm just kind of curious as to how that has all sort of fleshed out.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me mention this to you. I did not review the contract itself, other than the portion that involved us with John Marina's company about reviewing savings. I feel very comfortable with knowing that the representations made in the contract will be actually will come to fruition through that review with respect to the savings. But I'll ask you to do this. I invite you to talk with the services division of the Department of Administrative Services, David Hartwig and Dugan Petty. I was very impressed with the Silver Oak meeting with the representatives there. I thought they were highly competent. And it was a very, very detailed discussion in terms of how those savings were calculated. So I think that actually may be some testimony that would draw a crowd.
Okay.
Unlike mine.
Mr. Chair, if I might add here, I don't have the specific numbers, but this biennium, the cost of the Silver Oak contract versus the savings that were generated, we basically broke even. For 05-07, there were savings that were taken out of agencies' budgets based on the contract savings generated perpetuating into the future. And there's a phase two part of this that we're talking about doing next biennium that's will be under discussion by Ways and Means. So if you want to get into the specifics of it, I think George is correct that Dugan and Petty and David Hartwig would be the folks to have come talk to you specifically. But we feel like the contract has been a success for the state. And you're right, there is pushback, because anytime you get tougher on negotiation with vendors about the best price for the state and use leverage and purchasing power, that's what that's all about. And we have gotten better prices for the state. That has meant in some cases that we've switched vendors, and folks that have been doing business with the state for a long time haven't necessarily liked giving up their contracts to someone who was more competitive. So there's all those positives and pros and cons to any of that but methodology, but certainly they could answer those specific questions if you want to get into what the actual financial dollars were and what the returns were.
Okay.
Change is always a challenge, and you know, we've been engaged in that for this last biennium for 2 years, so we've learned some things, and there's a, you know, a future to look to in terms of what more the state might want to do in this area. I think the legislature was very interested in this and wanted the department to move in that direction, as well as the governor, in terms of trying to get better purchasing power results for the state.
Sure, sure, and I would agree. I agree with you that change is always tough, and yes, some vendors may or may not like it. I guess the thing that I'm particularly interested in is making sure that the quality of the products being purchased, the savings are there, but the quality of the product is either equal to or better than what we've gone away from.
And that was the intent, Mr. Chair. And I think that, of course, you know, we're listening to the agencies as they use those products and those contracts now, and it's a learning process in terms of are they getting their needs met by that particular product, and what do we need to do to make sure they do. So, yeah, it's a give and take.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
And I'll sum this up, Mr. Chair. We also have several audits in process that relate to the cost structure at the Department of Administrative Services, and I have nothing to report on those yet because we're in the midst of doing our field work, Margaret and I, and we intend to have those complete, we hope. The shared client services and the parking review we're doing should be complete, we hope, for our internal audit committee meeting in April. We are also looking at the day tripper pool in the fleet in terms of the optimum size and how we compute that, whether that's a valid computation, uniform rent, and the overall cost structure at the Information Resource Management Division, which I have to tell you I don't anticipate having finished for some time, though, because that is a that is an in-depth review that takes a lot of time.
The uniform rent is?
No, the Information Resource Management Division. Uniform rent is on our schedule. We have not yet begun that one.
Okay.
The last thing I'll mention to you are three reviews we completed late last year.
George, let me stop you for just a second. I'm sorry, but with regards to the shared client services, is there a list of services that you're developing or have developed that falls into that?
Oh, Mr. Chair, yeah, I'm sorry. Let me be more specific. I apologize. The Shared Client Service Unit exists within the State Controller's Division. They provide accounting, purchasing, some personnel services, and budget services to small agencies, very small agencies and boards and commissions. Our interest was to see whether or not we met what I call the market test. Were those services both valuable to the agencies that we surveyed, and did they think they were fairly priced? And then we went back to take a look at, or in the midst of finishing taking a look at, so that we can draft this report, what those costs actually were and how they were computed, and was that a fair and valid way to do it.
Okay.
So we're doing that now. What I've found preliminarily is, and certainly from the survey results from agencies, and they're not responding to a DAS survey, they're responding to Margaret Kane and I, we were curious about whether or not those services that they received were of value to them. I think you'd be surprised that the response was very good. If you'd allow me, one of the things I can tell you, I have great experience with shared client services now because I work with them very closely with the Employment Relations Board, a small agency that utilizes their services. And as part of our review of the Employment Relations Board, which stemmed from a request from the Emergency Board, we looked at their personnel, their workload, budget, purchasing, contracting, such things as the length of time it took to get a case out the door. We did a very, very thorough examination, and I'm happy to report that, and work very closely, by the way, with the Legislative Fiscal Office on that as well, And we did the report. It was not a report that was particularly glowing, I can assure you, but it was a report that was taken very seriously, and there have been many, many changes made as a result of it, including the board chair. So I think things are turning around there in terms of in my opinion, and certainly those that were on the team. What DAS does to leverage its resources, since there are only a few of us in the director's office that do this, is we actually get an interagency team together and do these reviews. So we try to save money wherever we can, but stretch ourselves as thin as possible and still do good work. In the case of the Employment Relations Board, I believe we were successful. Worked closely with both Legislative Fiscal Office, the Governor's Office, and Department of Administrative Services, Shared Client Services Division or Section. We also did that with the Public Employees Retirement System, which was a very, very long review, which the new board asked us to do. And as you know, as all of you know, there have been many, many substantial changes made that were touched on in our review. And we did a limited engagement with the state fair that also resulted from an emergency board action. And that was very simply a situation where their cash flow statement was sometimes done on a cash basis and sometimes done on an accrual basis. And, of course, as all of you know, and all of you intuitively know, especially Representative Butler, that's probably not a good way to manage your cash, certainly for purposes of forecasting what that cash will be. So they've changed that, and I think have their act together on that quite well.
So did they decide to go to an accrual basis or a cash basis?
Well, I think the safe thing is to do what we do, and that's basically cash basis. Theirs was a situation where a bond payment had been not missed. It had been missed in the report because they had the kind of unusual revenue bond situation of having a prepayment in addition to the payment, so they would book the prepayment. Well, they forgot to book the prepayment, and so the payment went through as made, but that left them short for purposes of the next prepayment because they thought they had booked that. I can tell you that it was a very complex review because it's very difficult to go in after the fact to construct what may have happened. But I was very, very glad to note that we didn't see any instances of fraud or misconduct. It was merely a mistake, and those things happen. So, with that, let me thank all of you because you've been very patient with me, and you always are, and I appreciate that. And that ends my testimony today.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to open it up for questions. Representative Rosenbaum, do you have a question or two or seven?
I think just one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure where this fits, but I thought I would ask it and see if it's something that's within your purview. I know a lot of other states have been looking at their public assistance programs, and for us it would probably be primarily the Oregon Health Plan, with an eye to where recipients are employed, because a number of them are employed, and whether taxpayers are subsidizing those employers by providing some of these benefits. Is that something that we have the ability to collect here? Would it require legislation to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, are you talking about the ability to collect the information?
To
get the information?
Right.
My suggestion to you and the committee is to talk with the Department of Human Resources has a very good internal audit section, and I can't imagine that isn't something that they've either looked at or have on their audit plan, but I would invite them to talk to you about that.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me.
Do you know, though, would it require a law to be passed to direct them to collect and provide that information to the legislature, or could we just ask for it?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, let me be clear. Let me make sure I'm clearly understanding your question. The information you're talking about is information about the private employers?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes,
for instance, the state of Georgia, I know, because I'm familiar with that a little bit, has found that they have something like the Oregon Health Plan that's called Peach Health there, and they were able to find this information, you know, and not violate anybody's confidentiality, but just in an aggregate form, find that they had some major employers that included Walmart that had a huge percentage of their workforce on public assistance getting their health benefits through the state of Georgia, and that's the kind of information that I'm talking about.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum. I would suggest to you that you actually talk to the Department of Human Services on that, because I don't know the answer. It seems to me that if it's aggregated, the data, then you wouldn't have a confidentiality issue.
It's only when it becomes disaggregated and actually says who it is that it would become, that there would be a confidentiality breach.
But certainly, to the extent that you can identify individuals, I think you do have a confidentiality issue there. But to the extent that you can't identify anybody in particular, I don't see the issue there. However, I'm certainly not the last word on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative?
Nope.
Okay.
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any other questions for Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this line of questioning is probably in regard to another issue that has come before the committee relative to those vendor collective administrative fees.
Those rascals.
That we've delved into from time to time. And I guess my concern is, after having met with Dugan Petty, that we're finding, or it appears, that the vendor collected administrative fees perhaps have a greater utilization now than what they used to have. In an attempt to try and have, I think he called it activity-based funding of various divisions of Department of Administrative Services. I guess my concern is that I would like to have some assurance that those from the first time I saw other funds unlimited expenditures on Department of Administrative Services budgets. I had thought those were probably pass-through items as opposed to a method of operating the Department of Administrative Service. In other words, I think when I first saw it it was on printing, I believe, that we had first seen them years ago. And I think that the motor pool may have been consolidated with printing at that time. My thought was that those items of administrative fees, pass-through administrative fees, were, and they weren't administrative fees at all. They were just the cost of the publication that was being disposed of. So therefore, we didn't know whether there was a stack of publications that cost us $2,000 that we were going to be selling during the biennium for $2,010 to get our money back out of those publications. But I became aware of this happening more and more as I met briefly this morning earlier with Dugan Petty relative to the fact that this is becoming quite a large amount of money that's coming through the agency, the Department of Administrative Services, for these vendor collected and assessed administrative fees. I guess my concern is, I'd like to have a really strong comfort level that those fees are being audited and supervised within the Department of Administrative Services. That I'm now even anxious about the fact that they are continuously appropriated. That I'm very concerned about the fact that they should be very closely monitored in the budgeting process. And as long as I know that the internal audit process that you're supervising is keeping a good track of those kinds of things, I'm not going to be nearly as worried. But I would like to perhaps have this discussion with the Legislative Fiscal Office to make sure that they track those as well as you folks within budget and management, and that we really have a pretty open and thorough, transparent discussion of the whole process of how we fund our various divisions of the Department of Administrative Services. So I just have you share with us that you have confidence that even though those continuously appropriated items may not have the same level of scrutiny, again, because I think my perception was previously that those were just pass-through items, but now I see that they're becoming more of a more of a part and parcel of what you're using for day-to-day administration and operation of the various divisions of Department of Administrative Services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I can't give you that assurance now. I don't have a specific worry about that now, but let me say this to you. I will look at that. I will look at that, and I'll look at that before you leave town.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, to clarify, too, the only division that uses that right at the moment in DAS budget so that you at least have that comfort level is the purchasing program that's in the State Services Division. And so that's not something used elsewhere in the department at this point. So
Division was it, Lori? I'm sorry.
The State Services Division, which is the division that has fleet and purchasing and surplus property, those kinds of services that are available not only to state government, but to other local governments and cities and special districts. So we have a wider customer base there, and we have to have ways to collect from them the administrative costs of operating that program so that it isn't just state agencies that are paying for it because other entities are also using it. So we need to have that follow-up with you, I think, and conversation. Be happy.
I think that would be good because questions that went relative to a bill that we saw, I think it's House Bill 2474, if my memory is serving me correctly. And that's relative to the printing industry, but we had submitted some questions, and so maybe we could have a further discussion on that issue relative to Lori, what you're talking about with regards to services and purchasing and mm-hmm. and that area, and maybe even a little bit of a logistical conversation about how that's put on. And whether it's sort of an understanding that everybody that uses that purchasing program, for example, knows that, you know, for example, if company X is bidding on to provide a, you know, janitorial supplies for the city of John Day, that they know that they've got to add onto their bid, you know, some kind of a percentage fee, and that the city of John Day understands that there's going to be this additional fee on there. And also, we might talk about the logistics of how that's added on. Is it simply buried in the bid, or is it actually shown as a line item? And I suppose that maybe that's dependent on how the vendor wants to do it. I don't know. But,
Chair, in fairness, in my earlier meeting today with Dugan Petty, he indicated that, and that was one of the questions that I did at request of him, and he responded in the affirmative that he would bring back the language that is presently being used in any bidding contracts and actually bring it back. How that's calculated, and there's an ancillary issue in that regard, and that is that, and we will get that back from him relative to the House bill that you've mentioned. The concern that I've got is that that if that was if those vendor collected assessments and the fees were allowed to be imposed by other departments without clearing them appropriately, then we will have the situation of agencies that could go out of control and actually be salting additional resources into their budgets, which we hadn't planned through the Ways and Means process. And the other concern that I expressed to Mr. Petty was that where we don't have, where the Department of Administrative Services doesn't control necessarily the disbursements for the Oregon Department of Transportation or perhaps the Treasurer's Office or those other folks. So if we're going to have a vendor-collected assessment against imposed by DAS against ODOT, and ODOT isn't paying its bills but once every 90 days or over 60 days, in many instances we've had testimony that even printing bills, it's not uncommon for those to go from 60 to 90 days out. And yet the proposal was that the VCAF would be imposed and collected every 15 days, even though the monies had not been received. And so what we've got is a request for private industry to be funding accounts receivable for the state government. I have a major concern over the long-term haul that we need to kind of get a real good examination of the whole VCAF program. We've attempted to do it, George. I'm sure you followed it, and followed it to the point in your office that Dugan voluntarily came forward and made the appointment to come in and visit with me about these kinds of things, and we've reviewed it somewhat, and he's going to give us the contract language. I'm just very concerned about the transparency of that. First of all, when we first saw it, it just didn't pass the smell test. These folks said, hey, wait a minute. We bid some contracts, and now we're having Department of Administrative Service come back and add 2% on those contracts, which we're going to have to put up out of our own cash, out of our own bottom line on this project. And we bid the project at what we thought was a low bid. And we won the low bid. And now we're being asked to contribute 2% of that back to a different department. So we've heard that concern. We're assured by the state printer, Mike Freeze has been here and has assured us that there's no intention to impose that VCAF again during the current session, but I recognize that if it's activity-based versus assessment-based method of running a department, it certainly is a valid thing to look at. My concern is that it move away from the whole concept of being other funds unlimited and become something that is an other funds limited, and we actually then budget for it and we do not continuously appropriate.
May I ask a question of the committee?
Sure.
Specifically, Representative Butler. Are you concerned, Representative Butler, that it is off the budget document? I mean, I just want to make sure I understand this before I go out and start looking at this.
No. George, my response to that would be that it's not necessarily that it's off the budget document, because I think that because of internal, I feel much better about the internal auditing that's being done in relationship to this. My concern is that we should know what it's going to cost to run each within a few percentage points each department within state government when we leave the building following the approval of the audits or the approval of the budget. My concern is that this gives another opportunity for a state agency or a department within a state agency to come in and take another bite of the apple without legislative oversight, and maybe not just without legislative oversight during that period, but maybe forever, because it's my understanding that the Form 333 can be, and I think 333 must have come from the Senate bill 333 in what, the 1995 session, is that where that came from?
A long time ago. Hmm.
Okay, and so what happens is that the 333 is run through the office, and then the fee is imposed, and then it's dropped off. And if that fee is imposed and dropped off in between the legislative sessions, it doesn't require legislative approval of the new fee because it doesn't exist the next legislative session. So I'm just anxious about the transparency of that whole process, that it moved to a line item budget in that process, as opposed to other funds unlimited, that we actually move it to another funds limited and not have a continuous appropriation of it. So that if we're going to be using it for the day-to-day administration of an agency. Just don't want to take a second bite of the apple.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, usually, as you know, the non-limited expenditure limitation that is approved in the Ways and Means at a certain dollar amount when the agency leaves the Ways and Means process. The difficulty, I think, with some of these services that we're talking about is it's hard to predict what the volume coming through might be, because we have so many players that are using that, and they have different factors that influence how much they might spend, especially when we're dealing with, we might have a good handle on what state government may be doing, but we don't necessarily know what local government, special districts, and others may be doing. So those are estimates, you know, based on past practice and usage. And if you limit that, as you know, the agency, if it goes over that amount, will then need to come back to the emergency board and have a discussion about what happened, which is certainly something that could be done if there needed to be a higher comfort level, I think, on the part of the legislature with those expenditures. But most of those that are in non-limited expenditure limitation are there for a reason historically over time. I think the legislature has felt that they don't want to have to be doing that when most of it is volume-driven by people deciding what to purchase. But clearly, you know, this is a mechanism to fund administrative costs for this program that's used by multiple players. There are other methods to assess administrative costs. It's just simply a matter of how are we going to decide we're going to pay for those, I think. And if the VCAF is uncomfortable, and it may be the name that's associated with it, I don't know, but simply, you know, it's trying to get at having a fair share of costs paid by all who are using the system. And it may be the most cost-effective way for the state to do that. Now, the private sector may not feel like that's a great partnership they want to engage in, and we'd have to set up other mechanisms that may be more costly for the state to collect those administrative fees some other way from all of the players that are participating in the benefits of the leverage of the purchasing power of coming in through those state negotiated contracts. Because clearly the local government, special districts, and folks look at what can they buy that for themselves, and then they look at the system and say, what could we buy it for off of here? And I'm assuming they're self-selecting where they can get the best deal. So those are the kind of issues I think that are faced under that purchasing program.
And Mr. Chair, I would question at that point. I have, again, because of my great confidence in Lori and George, I don't want to have anyone misconstrue the nature of this conversation, thinking that I believe that the least amount of money is going south or that there's any wrongdoing here. My concern is I just don't think it would necessarily always pass the transparency test, particularly the VCAF bill that we had before us relating to printing that seemed to be imposed and then not imposed, and nor will it be imposed during this next session. My concern, according to Mr. Freeze, my concern is that if we're going to fund this way, we need to make certain that all members of the assembly are notified. At first it didn't pass the smell test, that there was an after the fact fee imposed upon an item, and there's just, even though there was no wrongdoing or no it gave the appearance that somehow we've run short in difficult times, and so we're going to assess a fee on another agency, and here's how we're going to do it. And it seemed to be somewhat hidden, and I'm sure that wasn't intended to be the case. My concern here is that it appears that those VCAFs have been used to double the budget of the procurement department over the period while we've been going through times of difficult financial times, from $1.5 million in the 2001-03 session to $2.7 million anticipated now in the 2005-07 session. And if it's volume driven, if it's truly volume driven, and we are going out and getting a contract for fill in the blank, if it's to buy, using an example I used earlier today, maybe it's to buy a Ford automobile, and we get a bid on that Ford automobile at $30,000. How much additional cost do we have when people go in and buy from that dealer that's been advertised on the web? How much additional cost do we have from that point forward for everybody that wants to go in and buy, everyone, a governmental agency that wants to go in and buy, pick up one or ten of those $30,000 Fords? My position is, if it's properly posted on the web, that particular point, that the state, for having done the work to provide for the state, the fact that local governments or other municipalities might be able to, and those other municipalities, I assume, might even include other states. In the instance that was recited to me earlier in the day by Dugan and Petty. So I guess my concern here is that if maybe we're going to have to enter into the contracts, these contract arrangements with the other states that may be buying off our contracts, we can share that information, share it all online, and once we bid the contract, have a bid on the contract and it's posted, that particular point, I don't know why we've got to have a vendor, a VCAF, a vendor collected assessment, in regard to that. At that particular point, as long as it takes no additional paperwork by us, and then maybe enter into these arrangements in a multi-state arrangement. I know we do that with California and with Washington on larger equipment, industrial type equipment and vehicles and those kinds of things. So I'm just anxious that we may have tied into a new method to fund state government that has one department assessing another department just to operate. When the better part of it is, and I thought we had a state assessment and a local government assessment that we already had that were approved as part of the assessment rates with MDAS. And I know George has worked on a number of different assessment methods for number of employees, the size and number of square feet that you're using in state government, and those kinds of things. So I'm just not saying anything is wrong here. I just would like to see it transparent. Thank you.
And George will work on it.
I think the other point that you brought up, Representative, is the fact that when payment being made to the vendor is out 30, 60, 90 days, but it's expected that the vendor is going to pay the administrative fee within 15 days of sending the product, we have a disconnect.
Yes.
And we've got to figure out how we don't create a bigger problem, because quite frankly, if a vendor thinks that they're going to be out dollars even on a short-term basis, they're more likely to say, you know what, I don't think I want to waste my time bidding on the project.
Or Mr. Chair, we'll find, as we have in some instances, that it costs a state government bid for the same ream of paper might be more money than what you can just go down to the store and buy it for.
That's very true. Well, thank you. Thank you, members, for this good conversation. George, as always, it's been a pleasure to have you here. I think you feel the same, but I'm not sure. And Lori, thank you very much. Margaret, thank you for sitting in. We appreciate that. And I don't think we have anything else at this point. Tuesday, we'll have... We're going to bring back 2474, I think, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And then, we're going to. And then we have some other things that we'll be doing that are escaping me right now. But anyway, thank you again.
Thank you, Mr.
I'll close the informational hearing, and we will stand adjourned. Thank you.